You're listening to a podcast on the Awkward Human Network. If you want to find out more about this show and all the other cool stuff that we do, visit awkwardhuman.com.
Let's talk about you. Welcome to What's Wrong With You. Each episode, we'll ask one guest the same series of four questions.
What's wrong with me? I've been taking a lot of
Just the next question. Tell me about a time that you failed.
It's a loaded question.
The third one. If you could go back in time and tell yourself one thing, how real do you get with people about
it? Don't tell because they think I'm a crazy person.
What would you say?
I'd say prepare everybody else.
I'd say just go in and watch.
You're gonna fuck up and then fess up and then fix
it's a great beer,
it.
Sweet beer, man.
Yeah, great beer.
For sure. Okay.
And the last question, when does that come up now? When do you think about that moment or that failure or that lesson? Who am I? I'm your host, Sarah Kleigman. Coming up on this episode of What's Wrong With You. This episode was much harder to record than I thought it would be. I figured if I'm asking all of my guests to go through this series of questions, then I need to put myself through it as well. Instead of sitting alone in the studio and talking to myself, I invited Paul Provenza to come and help me. He's interviewed everyone from Trey Parker and Matt Stone to Eddie Izzard, George Carlin, Margaret Cho. If anyone is qualified to be asking these questions, it's him. I thought after being on this side of it, switching roles would be easy. And I was totally wrong.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Paul.
First, before I ask you some questions, let me just say that I'm very honored and delighted to be the one asking you these questions.
Oh, my goodness. If I start to express how excited I am about you doing this, I'll lose all cool factors.
You'll lose all credibility.
So I'm just going to be like, yeah, no, whatever. It's so cool. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, I guess.
Well, I love the idea behind all of this. And I think it's really fearless of you to put yourself in the interviewee seat.
Thank you.
So let's start. Let's not waste any time and get right to it. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh, God. You know, you would think that I would, given the fact that I've done many of these, that I would have an immediate, this is what I've been thinking about.
Well, it's actually not that kind of question. I mean, it's a really tough question.
It's so tough. But the thing I've said to people is that leading up to being asked the question, your answer will probably change a lot when you're thinking about it.
Right.
And it did. Because for me, the what's wrong with you is one of the most important questions of why I started the show. There is so much wrong with me, and there's all these different ideas of failure and success. And I feel like the things that are constantly bringing me down are worrying about those things, times that I failed, things that are wrong with me. And I'm not avoiding the question.
You mean not letting go of those?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Giving those things more meaning than they need to have, and feeling like you are the only one with this thing. You're not going to be at cocktail parties and be like, hey, this is great. So who else has clinical depression? Am I right?
You know what? I think that would be a great way to that. That's what our socialization should be like. Just go, hi, I'm Paul. Have serious damage.
Yes.
Let me tell you about it. And get it all right out there.
Right out there.
I think that might be a wise idea. That's what dogs do at the dog park when they sniff each other. They're basically getting all that information.
That's, I think, what season two should be called. Just like ass sniffing. What's wrong with you? Getting right to it.
Sarah's dog park. Well, here's the other thing that's interesting about this and why this is such a challenging question. I know this is not you answering it, but I'm struck by it because we ask a question like that and you're expected to answer a question like that, but we don't have the same definitions of success, wrong, failure, any of those things. And one of the things that's plagued me my whole life is this constant sort of reevaluation of like, well, maybe that thing that was so fucked up is actually the best thing possible. And it's just this constant back and forth with all that sort of stuff. So how do you define right?
Yeah.
Let's start with that.
How do I define right? I guess not broken, right?
Uh-huh. Is it peaceful, happy?
It's I guess right is
balance.
Impossible as I'm. Yeah, balance, healthy inside and out. It's, you know, sort of average okayness, I guess. So the what's wrong with you would be the outliers.
Socially acceptable okayness or personally individually acceptable?
It should be the personally individually acceptable. But I think the truth is that it's that most people, myself included, are affected by the fear of what other people are thinking, which at the end of the day, like, everyone is way too self-absorbed to be worrying about anyone else's problems.
Yeah. We're the only ones that think any of this matters to
anybody. Exactly. Yeah. And I'll get to the question. We're going to get a little...
I'll tell you what's wrong with you is you can't even...
I can't even get there.
This question.
I know. I need like a little warm-up time. Growing up,
yeah,
I grew up in northern Michigan. I was the only Jew in my school. Lovely, lovely town. Upper middle class. Parents are still together. No problems. Everyone's pretty healthy. Nothing terrible in my life had ever happened to me. And of course, I felt guilty about that. I've always been a very empathetic person, but I had this fear that the empathy comes off as disingenuous if it is revealed that I didn't have anything wrong with me.
That you led a privileged and drama-free life.
Yeah. But then I grew up a little, and turns out the older you get, the more shit breaks inside and out. And all of these things started to come to the surface. You know, I was diagnosed with clinical depression. I have hearing loss. I have endometriosis. All of these different things. And it took me looking at all those things and being like, going from a place of like, why me? Like, why am I dealing with all this bullshit? To, well, fucking thank God me, because I want to talk about it and I can talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so many people with all of the things that are wrong with me, a lot of them are things that people don't want to talk about or are afraid of talking about.
Right.
There's hearing aids. There's such a big stigma.
Yeah, I don't. What is that about? I mean, this should be on par with getting glasses. What is that about?
Because it has connotations of age.
No, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I wasn't thinking.
And it also has connotations of disability. I gave this talk on the process of getting my hearing aids, and I mentioned something that my audiologist said, which was, there was a lawyer that was so afraid to wear his hearing aids in court because he was worried that it would make him look like it would discredit him with the jury, which is fucking bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like if he had a funky pair of glasses, they'd be like, that guy looks sharp.
Right.
Like, he's probably smart.
Yeah.
So I had all these issues, right? Yeah. That and like the endometriosis thing, like it has something to do with a uterus. There's a vagina near that. You're talking about it.
Uh-huh.
That sort of thing. And and once I sort of accept that, like, fuck it. You know, like this is who I am, and that's the value. It's easier, and I get to be like, oh, this is why all these things are wrong with me. I think it was all of it together. Like, the real place that this is going is that I felt like I had more dues to pay.
Okay. So like, did that affect your perception of success? Like, you didn't deserve it because you hadn't paid enough dues and didn't suffer any hardship to get to that? Or
it was like, it's like, why should they listen to me, right? Like, what do I have to say that isn't like, all right, next up is this well-off nice young Jewish girl from the Midwest. She's gonna talk about how she bakes challah and had a great weekend. Like, it's not that I was like hoping terrible things would happen to me, but I was hoping terrible things would happen so that I would be able to experience these things. And so,
well, you see, I understand that as a comic. I understand that because there are a lot of comics who really had wonderful childhoods and aren't particularly outwardly damaged in the ways we would assume. And they do have to deal with the fact that it's like in the same way that if you're just a middle class white guy, you sort of have to deal with that now in comedy.
Yeah.
You know, that you're one of those middle class white guys, and that means something to the way people perceive you. And the same thing where they felt guilty about not having had the kind of suffering that so many other comics around them had. And do they have any value at all if they had a happy childhood?
Right. Right. No. Right. Exactly. That all sort of ended up putting me in a place where I felt the need to help others so much more than myself, because I felt like if I was privileged with these things and I'm not suffering in any way, then I can help these people in a way that doesn't matter if it's harmful or detrimental or exhausting for me. It doesn't matter. It's what that turned into was really kind of how I got started in management. I've always been very creative, always been a writer, did, you know, lots of stage stuff growing up, did voice, tons of stuff. But then I sort of walked away from that in some ways. And I read Bernie Brillstein's book, which was amazing. But and he talks about, you know, what it was like to be a manager. It was a very different time for reps, right?
Yeah. And he had particularly more heart than most.
Yes, exactly. Okay. More heart than most, and a more creative relationship with his clients.
Right.
So I read that book when I was 20. And I was like, that's what management is. Amazing. I have inside me the ability to speak both languages. I can speak the artist language. I can speak the business language. So it is my duty.
And it gives you a sense of purpose to enable others to achieve what they can do artistically.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay. So I protected and supported these people that I worked with. And I don't get me wrong, like, and we'll, I'm very proud of everything I did as a manager, and I love all of my clients, but I gave way too much of myself to the point that I burnt out by the time I was 25.
So this impulse to help in some way, is it motivated by guilt to some degree?
I think at first it was. I think in some ways, I mean, fuck, I'm Jewish. Everything's motivated by guilt.
It's just a seasoning.
Yeah, yeah. I think in some ways, I don't know, guilt gets confused with the sense of duty.
Okay.
It's not that I was doing things that I didn't want to be doing. It's just that the negative effects it had on me were irrelevant because the important thing was the doing or the person that I was supporting.
So you were actually putting your goals, which were not about yourself necessarily, ahead of your own well-being.
Exactly.
So you needed to pull back just to take care of yourself.
Exactly.
And was that a struggle for you to say that I deserve at least as much attention as the people outside me?
It's something that I am still coming to terms with and still trying to convince myself of in many ways.
So as you look back on that time, do you see in any way that you made it more detrimental for yourself than it needed to be? That you made it take more of a toll? Somebody very close to me has a tendency to stress over everything and create such anxiety around everything that it makes whatever task, whatever she's trying to accomplish, 10 times harder, and actually is what makes her unwell. Yeah, if she could take away the stress that she creates for herself on this, it actually would be a nice, easy ride.
I think a lot of people struggle with that. And I think in some ways it was one of my favorite things that someone would say whenever you're freaking out, which I'm sure everyone's heard, is like, you're not curing cancer.
Right.
Like, you're not. Right. And with comedy, like, I especially had to remind myself of that. Like, I think it was some night and Alonzo Bowden, he was in Canada somewhere and he was on some awful tour and everything was going wrong. And I'm here in L.A., like, you know, as his manager, trying to look after him and make sure he's taken care of. And I'm just frazzled as fuck. And I'm like, stuff is everywhere. And Alonzo, you know, he calls me and I'm just like, I'm so sorry. Like, we're gonna figure it out. It'll be like totally fine. Like, da, da, da. And then the next night, him and Matt Kirshen, another one of my clients, an amazing comedian, they were hanging out at the bar and they decided to text me like some joke that I think they were texting me that like Alonzo, they're like, Alonzo's drinking again. Something like really dramatic. I believed it and didn't realize they were fucking with me. And I was like, oh my God. And then when they finally told me they were fucking with me, I just laughed. And it was like, yeah, they're on a comedy tour in Canada. You don't need to take years off of your life, Sarah, because they're fucking staying in a shitty hotel room. Like, they'll be fine.
Yeah, it's not like anybody's going to die because they didn't get the right room service order.
Right.
I think it's because we're not being attacked by wolves and bears. And if we were being attacked by wolves and bears, we would have something rational to put all of that stuff to. But because there's so little that affects us anymore, that with all of this kind of evolutionarily honed sense of energy and fear and alertness and all, I think we have to turn it in on stuff that just doesn't matter.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Because all of these things that take you out of balance in life are kind of the currency of art.
Right.
So when you're doing something creative or you're doing something in with an artistic impulse, it's hard not to experience that. That's you know, the artist suffering. It's not necessarily that, you know, they can't pay the rent or don't eat. It's the internal struggle of having to live in that space and have all of that stuff present all the time, even though it's not necessarily your actual life.
Right.
You're still having these feelings and these dynamics going on. And that's a struggle. But so when you talk about the creative or the artistic life, I feel like that's different from a life, go to work 9 to 5, you have your own schedule, your own life, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
You know, you don't necessarily have to deal with a lot of that angst. A lot of people, of course, do have to deal with that angst because it's going to happen one way or another.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the creative existence, that sort of these kinds of, and that's kind of your in, that's the weather for you for the rest of your life. You know, this is the thing that comes back to comedy for me, duh, which is that one of the great things about comedy is it gives us permission. What comedy does for people on an emotional and psychological level, it gives them permission that they don't feel bad. or that they laughed at this thing or that they're laughing now with a room full of people that they didn't even, obviously everybody understands and relates or they wouldn't get the joke. And so like the thing that is so deep down inside, it kind of gets permission to just be and to not judge it so harshly. And that's a thing that I think people really are desiring, whether they're aware of it or not, is permission, just to be.
Yes.
To not have to fit some mold or to just be, to be broken, you know?
That's the show.
Okay, so tell me about a failure that you experienced.
So I was going to talk about leaving management.
Okay, so where's the failure part?
Because
you knew you were unhappy and you wanted to move on. So where is the failure in that?
That I burnt out. That I was so affected.
Right. You figured out who you were and it wasn't that. And that's your failure.
That's my failure. But it's not. But at the time, it felt like it.
We really need to define failure.
Yeah, that's, help me out. How do you define failure?
Well, I mean, like when I think about that question, what's your biggest failure? I can, go from every audition I didn't get.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
There's that. And then there's, you put your heart and soul into a project and it goes its path and then it just grinds to a halt. And well, that could be perceived as a career failure, but not necessarily a creative failure.
But neither of those are complete failures. Just the fact that you created this creative thing.
Well, then nothing is a complete failure.
Well, then fuck this show.
I think that's what I think that's...
That's the point.
That's what gets manifested here, but... You know, I'll tell you a failure that I maintain is a failure, and there is no good that comes of it. And I just learned really, really slowly, but I learned. The first time I did The Tonight Show with Johnny, it was kind of a monster, and they asked me to come back again the following week, and I didn't. And I chose not to. Ostensibly, outwardly, because as I put it, well, you know what? I don't have anything to promote right now, so I don't want to just do a spot without, being able to sell tickets off the back of it or something. It's just strategically, that was a sound argument, but it really was fear. I was just afraid that my second spot would be such a drop off from the first spot, and only a week later,
right.
And it was all my own fear and insecurity. And as a result of my not having done that show a week later, it was probably another 2 years or maybe three before I was back on The Tonight Show. And that's haunted me. You know, when people say they have no regrets in life, like, well, if you can't look back on your entire life and regret anything, fuck just that. That ain't right.
Yeah.
That's one of the biggest is that, you know, even if I had gone on and done an okay set would be, I would say, about the worst that I could do. And the worst that would happen from that is absolutely nothing.
Right.
I should have, and I was afraid. And the awareness of what the truth was about that decision for me has haunted me for a long time until I could actually even confront myself to say, no, you were afraid, and you know you were afraid, and you still haven't learned that lesson because now you're having this internal conversation about this other thing. That, to me, is a failure. Okay, so failure... Which, frankly, I just don't think you're answering the question. It doesn't feel like failure to me at all.
I think
you failed answering that question.
Oh, shit. My worst fear of how today would go.
I think you're failing at answering the question about failure.
Ugh.
Because I don't think that's really failure. I can understand the feelings you might have about that internally, but I don't think that's the way... We shouldn't accept that as your failure story.
All right. Okay. When I was in school in Chicago, I was going to film school. I was probably 18, maybe.
Where were you? Northwestern?
Columbia. Somehow, it might have been through Craigslist. I got...
No good story starts that way.
Or all good stories start that way. I think it was through Craigslist. And I got connected with this guy who we'll call Giovanni. Well, Giovanni was starting a studio in Chicago. And never mind that it was in a shitty neighborhood. Never mind that it really was just basically like an old factory building. Never mind any of that. It's a dream. And he's going to bring in all of these young, hungry film school kids to help make it come true. And somehow he got like a kind-hearted man with some extra cash laying around, who, really sweet guy. And they started this weird thing. And it was this like warehouse space in downtown Chicago. And they started behaving as though it was like a studio. Like they like put like shitty chairs in this room, and we would like read scripts and like make script reports and like, you know, started producing these like mediocre scripts and taking it very seriously. And I saw opportunity there. I saw resources there. I saw the beginning of something great. Mm-hmm. I saw being a part of the beginning of something great. So I brought in everyone I could convince to come, and I convinced everyone to come. I was the one that was doing all these, you know, producing all these short films, and so I would always, you know, be like, you know, hiring people to do, you know, whatever was needed. So they were used to getting things, hearing from me, and bringing them into something moderately interesting at least. Right. And so I brought all of them in. And it was a few months of this, and we made a bunch of like shitty shorts, and no one was getting paid, but like it was payment deferred. So, you know, that's what that means. I had no idea what that meant. And at the time, it really wasn't about the money either, but I think the idea that like you are doing this is of value and you will be paid right. for your work.
Right. But of course, they learned something, and they got a chance to express something. A chance to develop.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff.
So a couple months later, one of my good friends had written a Power Rangers fan film.
Power Rangers fan film.
Yeah, like fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And he had saved up a lot of his own money, and he brought it to the studio. And he was like, let's do this. Like, I'll direct this. I'll pay for it. It's all my money. Like, it's this like awesome, fun thing. We'll have like special effects or whatever. And this company that I'm not even sure was a company took it on and behaved very, very seriously about it, right? So even though it was this like shitty studio, like I'm talking like gross floors, like
so like the perfect opportunity for an alternative kind of a studio,
right.
they just
made it
started
weird.
Playing by the same awful rules of a firmly entrenched studio.
Exactly. Which it defeats the point. So my friend Chris, whose show this is, he put in all of his own money, and one of the last days of shooting, what was going to be one of the last days of shooting, we were in the woods, and it was like the one. Do you know what cicadas are?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like they're not around every year.
It's like every 7 years, or
right.
like 12 years or something.
Yeah, we got lucky because it was a fucking cicada year, which any audio engineer listening to this will be like, oh, fuck that. So we had to do all this bullshit and wait for stuff, and then like it started raining and just all of these issues happened. And I was assistant directing. So it was my job to schedule everything. And at the end of what would have been like the second to last day, I looked at how much we had to stop, how much time we lost for cicadas, for rain, for whatever. And I was like, we need to start 2 hours earlier tomorrow than we had originally planned, or else we're going to have to add a day of production. And that doesn't exist in the budget. And so we just needed to do this. And so I brought it to our quote unquote air quote producer, Giovanni, and told Giovanni what I thought.
When last we saw Giovanni.
And Giovanni told me that was not possible because we are operating under union rules, and union rules require that there needs to be a certain amount of space, like time between when you wrap on set.
Turnaround, yes.
Uh-huh. So I was like, okay. The cast and the crew was sleeping. It's like uh-huh. air mattress upstairs, like uh-huh. asbestos, fucking like yeah. whatever.
That's why it has the potential to be a really cool thing.
It did have the exactly. And so I saw exactly. And so I went around to like every single individual involved. And I was like, hey, if we make call time 2 hours earlier tomorrow, are you cool? If you're not cool, that is fine. I will not tell anyone it was you. I won't do no fucking pressure. But like if you're down,
right.
then cool.
Right.
Everyone was like, fucking yeah, of course we're down. What are you talking about? Like, what? Sure.
Yeah, yeah,
great.
Yeah.
yeah. So I went back to Giovanni and I said, Giovanni, I've talked to the cast and crew and they're down with it. And I think we need to do it. If we don't do it, you know, we're screwing production. And he still said no. So then I went to Chris and I was like, hey, this is what's going on. They said no, we need to do this. We're just going to do this, like secretly. So the next morning, we call the drivers early. We get the cast and crew, wake up their sleepy little heads, and pile them on to the transportation 2 hours early. Giovanni was not there at the time. Obviously, Giovanni found out. We had a great shoot day. Get back to the studio. Everyone's unloading. Giovanni grabs me and pulls me into his office with him, and this guy we'll call Mike. And Mike is this like Italian, like, you know, he's the kind of guy that like gets drunk on whiskey and then tells you how much he loves you and then like all the shit he's been through and then like also plays like, you know, guitar. He's just, you know, passionate, great. You know what he is? He's a creative guy who sometimes masquerades as a business guy. Uh-huh. And Giovanni. And they take me into the room and we sit down in chairs and they lecture me and then they fire me. And like, keep in mind, I hadn't received any money for this. I had been working on all of their productions. We did a fundraiser to send one of them to Sundance and I like pranced around in like a cigar girl outfit like, selling raffle tickets and my blood, sweat, tears, everything was in this place. Not only that, I had brought all of my people. I had taken my word to all these people. Mm-hmm. Everyone heard about what happened. And the next day, everyone left. They were like, they finished the production stuff they needed to do because they didn't want to screw over Chris, but they all left the studio. And I wasn't like, who's coming with me? Like, I just left. And then they all left. And then eventually, you know,
now it's a skate park.
No, I don't even think it's as cool as a skate park. So that the failure there wasn't necessarily getting fired. The failure there was bringing all of these people into something that I naively thought was a good bet.
Yeah, going to get asbestos poisoning. God failure.
Damn
I'm
it,
still not
Paul.
Buying that as failure because that's...
I got fired. I got a bunch of people who had committed to doing this thing, to being a part of this thing, to abandon their commitments as well, wasting everyone's time. No one got paid.
A failure is like if you had fucked up, if you said to everybody be there 2 hours early and then, you know, it turns out it was a union shoot and then the production had to pay $50,000 in fines and penalties, and that would be a failure.
Yeah.
You need to start writing songs with Alanis Morissette because the vague notion of failure is equivalent to her vague notion of irony.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not buying these as failures.
What if my parents said when that happened, that they were happy because I hadn't failed yet. I had done very well.
I don't see that as failure either. I mean, bad judgment isn't the same as failure.
Isn't it though?
And is it bad judgment if you know, you got those people involved completely believing the place you were in, it didn't reveal itself to be not that until later. You'd have to be, you know, psychic to know. It doesn't seem to me like you failed in terms of the values you put forth, the people you got involved in, the reasons you got them involved are all virtuous and righteous and what you're really about and really are who you are. And so the fact that that went south is not your failure, it's theirs.
Yeah. I felt like bringing people into a situation so early before I knew what was what.
Okay, meaning you should have vetted it
a little bit more.
Vetted it more.
Yeah, I met a guy on Craigslist. He took me to a fucking abandoned place and was like,
the Craigslist part. Yeah, that does, man. That does change it.
You know why? You know what? Because he had an IMDb page, and at the time, that's totally what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was a failure, and it demonstrated poor judgment.
Yeah.
That's really what the failure was. Was just you should know better than that.
Now I'm trying to think of like a hardcore failure. That's not that.
See, you are privileged.
Fuck, shit.
you're not even damaged enough to be on your own podcast.
Oh, God.
Okay, so if you could go back in time and speak to a younger you, what is the one thing or the first thing or the most important thing that you would let yourself know?
I would say you know what your dreams are. You know what you want to do in life. You know what you're drawn to. You know that. You don't need to pay dues in a certain way. You don't need to learn about XYZ. You don't need to prepare. There's nothing to prepare for. The life of a creative person, of a passionate person, is not you're not going to have health insurance and a 401k and whatever. And that's that stability for me was always like, my parents was very supportive, but always very much like, yeah, that's great. But like, what about your 401k? Like, what about health insurance? Like, what about, you know, all those sort of reasonable things, which are reasonable, but you fucking figure it out. So the roundabout way, the thing that I'm saying is, don't stop doing the things that you feel like you should be doing when you know what you want to be doing.
Right.
And when you know that you're not happy, right. If you're not happy, that's enough to say no. That's enough to change your mind. That's enough to do something else. If you're not happy, that's enough. Or if something's not enough, that's enough, mm-hmm. You know? So I think it was staying in places too long and denying what I really wanted because I felt like I might not be deserving of it.
Huh. Not so much that you didn't really know what you really wanted.
I knew, yeah.
Or you see, so you knew.
I
just
knew.
Didn't feel like you deserved it. Oh, that's interesting.
Or it was too risky, or I shouldn't, because one reason or the other.
Fear, basically.
Yeah, fear. 100% fear. Yeah. Don't be a pussy. Is that what I can go back and say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, mine would be about fear too, because one of my big issues was impatience, and that really just is an extension of fear, you know, that if it's not right there in front of me, I'm afraid that it'll never be there or
right.
whatever, for lack of an analogy. But fear, yeah, fear is really it's really the killer, and when we think about, in retrospect, when you think about things you were afraid of in your life, almost all of them now are silly. Like, there really is, it's not that big a price to pay. And most of the genuine failures that anybody has, really, the
downside, was that a dig at my failures again?
It is. It's a dig at how you failed in answering the failure question. But no, I think most people will also see that the downside wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be.
Right.
You know, and there are really difficult moments in people's lives, and they are sort of, you know, ground shaking, and they leave people homeless. And I'm not saying those things don't exist or that we're responsible for them. But for the most part, the shit that we're anxious and fearful of is nonsense. It's
yeah.
nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, that, like, to get back to the story I told you before, that Tonight Show thing, I mean, I was afraid that I wouldn't have an insanely great set twice in a row. Like, why is that the bar for everything all of a sudden? I had one fluky, amazing first spot, and then now that's my barometer.
Right, like, how is being, it's so, like, successful?
It was an out-of-body experience for me. I was looking at it going, even I don't think this shit's this funny. You know, and like, why all of a sudden is that the thing that would determine whether or not, you know, I'm ready to do another one? And it was just fear, all of it. Fear,
yeah.
it's all bullshit. Most of life is bullshit, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to be afraid of bears and tigers and shit, and that would change things big time.
I think so.
So what happens when you're confused about what it is that you really want?
Yeah. What does someone do if they're confused about?
Yeah, I had a similar thing to you, that I knew that I wanted to do comedy from a very young age. So as I went through, you know, my school career and college and everything, all of that was informed by the fact that I knew I wanted to do comedy. But there are people who don't know what they want to do, and it takes a long time for them to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really difficult position to be in. Even if your impulse is to follow your heart, you don't know what your heart really is about.
I think that the answer to that question is follow your curiosity. If you can't follow your heart, if your heart isn't telling you where to go, follow your curiosity.
And go in as many different directions as
yeah.
you can.
Yeah.
Oh, that's valuable. Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Was that joy? Is that redeeming enough of a statement?
Okay, yes.
Great.
Unequivocally.
Okay, great.
Okay, so that story, when does that come up, and in what context does it come up now? And is it a struggle now?
I have to remind myself of that every day these days. The don't be a pussy thing, the follow your heart, you know what you want to do, the not being afraid of failing. That is something I literally remind myself of every day. That's something that, like, doing this show is a risk. Saying these things is a risk. Thinking about what, if someone hears part of this out of context, if someone hears, all of these things are fear, right? But they're things I know I want to do. And whether it's with this show or with storytelling stuff I do, or the fucking, like, weird challah flavors I want to make,
yeah.
You know, operating from a place of worrying about other people other people's opinions or in a negative sense, right? Obviously, right. Like very right. empathetic, of course, right. you care about people. But these days, that follow your heart is something that I am trying to make the loudest voice in everything I'm doing, because I do believe that creatively, in order to create something that is meaningful for people and helpful for people, entertaining for people, it is going to be risky.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't always going to be straightforward. I mean, this is a great example. The fact that I'm here with you right now. I mean, you know, I didn't know, like, God, I'm like, Paul, it's like he's interviewed like everyone and he's been on this other side of the table of so many, like, I mean, the things you've done are amazing. And for me to be like, okay, so I'm going to ask Paul if he's down to do the show is...
You know, somebody said something to me recently that really stuck with me, which is that you never have to really worry about the people who say no. You don't have to worry about the people who say yes. The people who say yes are the ones who want to be there, that want to be involved, that are connected in some way. And those are the ones you worry about because they're making that commitment. They're on that side of the fence. They're with you in that endeavor. But we care so much about all the no's.
Right.
And they're pointless.
Totally pointless.
You know, you don't need all of those yeses. You only need a couple. So does some of that come from a fear of rejection?
Yeah, I think it's fear of like blowing a shot that doesn't exist.
Right. Sacrificing something that you actually don't even have yet.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
We are the strangest species, aren't we?
Goes deep. Goes
really
deep.
Really fucking weird.
Really weird. What drives us? Just fucking just fear and...
That's why I love my dogs and cats, because I watch them and I go, it really is humanity just... Just with all the
bullshit gone.
Taken off. Yeah,
yeah,
it's like, just right there.
When my cat is like, I'll be like on conference calls at home and my cat will be just fucking sitting there staring at me, meowing repeatedly, just repeatedly. And part of me, I'm like, God, you're so annoying. And then part of me is also like, man, if he was a little human, he probably wouldn't be like, hey, do you want to hang out? Hey, I want to hang out with you. Do you want to hang out? Can we hang out? Do you want to hang out? I want to hang out right now. What are you doing? Because he would be like, oh, I don't want to be desperate or like a nerd or like whatever. But he's
right,
a cat, so he doesn't fucking care. So he's like, I want to hang out right
so
now. This is what I want.
It's all right there. It's all pure. Right. Nothing hiding.
No.
It's like being in an Italian family. You know what I never had to say growing up to anybody in my family?
What?
Hey, what do you really mean?
Yeah. I didn't really feel about that.
What are you really trying to say?
Yeah.
What are you getting at? Well, did we get everything out?
I think we got all the things. I regret disappointing you in my failures. I will be sure to...
You're a failure as a failure.
No, I will fuck up. Mark my words.
This is very interesting. And I've enjoyed talking with you about all this stuff. And just unpacking everything is always so compelling to me.
And there's so much there. Yeah.
I just think there's this idea of what we should be or should be doing or how we should behave, all that sort of stuff. I think our lives don't really contribute the room to figure all that out. And so we end up locking into identities and philosophies and narratives that really are sophomoric.
Yeah.
Because they happen when we're really young.
Right.
And I just wish we lived in a world where there was a lot more yes and.
Yeah, me too.
All right, that's a good button.
That's a great button. Can I actually ask you before we wrap it up, would you mind reading that quote?
Oh, the Taylor Negron.
Yeah,
quote.
We're in Paul's guest house right now, and I was over here the other night and saw this on the wall.
Yeah, this is a piece that was printed out. It was one of many quotes of Taylor Negron's that were at the memorial in his honor, and I just ripped it down and framed it. It's a reference to him having studied with Lucille Ball, who was profound for him. He says, "Thinking back now, I feel I learned a lot from Lucy. I learned about being careful about what you want. Because sometimes more tears are cried over answered prayers than unanswered ones. You have to be clear with yourself, because sometimes when the road ends, your destiny begins. And then you're stuck living a life that wasn't even yours to begin with." Taylor Negron.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Paul. I can't tell
Thanks
you how much this means
me.
To me, and you're so wonderful. And I can't wait until the roles are switched.
Okay.
And I'll have you back on, and we'll dig deep.
I'll show you failure.
Okay.
I got it.
Find out more about today's guests or leave me a message at whatswrongwithyoupodcast.com. If you like the show, please share it with a friend or five and leave us a review on iTunes or Google Play. Thanks for listening.